In the federal employee viewpoint survey that the Partnership for Public Service compiles, we were tied for second to last out of 19 large agencies, so essentially 18th out of 19th large agencies. And we're the Department of Labor, and we need to be the model employer. And that was an important mandate from Secretary Perez. And so from day one, we focused not on just getting our numbers up, about really engaging our employees in the work and the important work that we do here at the department.
Obviously, the numbers were telling you stories, but I imagine that employees might not have been so forthcoming if you just stopped them in the hall. So how did you get them to open up?
Well, the first thing was doing listening sessions, not only around this building with different affinity groups, but also around the country. I've been to 8 out of our 10 regions, and I've done listening sessions in all 8 of those regions. People do. Amazingly, when you make yourself as available as the secretary and I do, people do stop you in the hallway. People do tell you things in the cafeteria. I announce very early on that I get coffee in the morning at 8 a.m., and I get lunch at 12 noon in the cafeteria, and I encourage people to come up to us. And so there was no shortage of people reaching out to us. We also started an online portal called Idea Mill, which is an electronic suggestion box, which was a way for people to provide feedback to us in a way if they weren't comfortable telling us in a public setting.
So when you got coffee at 8 o'clock in the morning and people came up to you, what were some of the common things they were saying?
It's everything from the computers need work to the building is too hot, the building is too cold, to more serious problems. People didn't like the fact that they had to sign in and sign out at the beginning and the end of the day. People didn't like the lack of flexibility in terms of their working hours. We heard that, why don't we have a microwave in our cafeteria? And so there were both big things and little things, and we just took all of that in and then started working on it. This has been an ongoing process, and we fully recognize that we can't fix these problems overnight, but it was important not only to listen, but to start acting on some of these ideas that we had heard.
One of your union officials, Denny DeMay, spoke with me. He said he'd been at Labor since 1980, and Secretary Perez has been the best leader that he's worked with. And so I want to know from your perspective, how did Perez set the tone, and what do you think he's done that is right in terms of the employees?
Well, I think it's the first thing is putting employees first. It's a recognition that in these budgetary times, while we would love to have more money to hire more people, to have better technology, and we're certainly going to advocate for all of that, our real ability to perform the mission of this department, which I think is one of the most noble missions in the federal government, is really dependent on getting more out of our employees. And every study you look at that says that a more engaged workforce is a more effective workforce and a more efficient workforce. And so it was really putting people first and constantly talking about it. And it wasn't something we just did once a year when the survey came out. It was all the time. There is not a day that goes by that either the secretary or I don't talk about engagement 5 times a day. And it's not only a top-down. We've really asked each of our assistant secretaries, all of our sub-agency heads, to take this seriously. Each of them has to come up with a plan for engagement, and we hold their feet to the fire on this every time we meet with them.
So let's go back to those sign-in, sign-out sheets that you heard people complain about a year and a half ago. What were they and what were people saying?
What we heard is that we're professionals. In a climate in which you want people to be taken seriously for their work, you want to value their work, there was something wrong about signing in every morning, signing out at the end of the day, that we needed to treat them as professionals, we need to treat them with a greater respect. And it was a very tangible way in which, under the old system, it signaled that employees weren't trusted. And we decided, you know what? Given the flexible hours that we want to create, the way that we want, the level of respect we want to provide our employees, it's a very easy symbol of what is wrong with this department. So we got rid of them.
It seems so simple, it makes you wonder why it wasn't done earlier.
I don't know that this is unique to the Department of Labor. There is certainly a school of management, a school of supervision that you manage by seeing people in their offices or seeing people in the hallway. And that certainly is the way that this department was run. And frankly, many workplaces are still run right now. It was more important for us to recognize that people can work in all places at all different times, and simply the fact that they were physically in the office for 8 hours was probably not the best indication of whether they were doing their jobs or not. And as I said, it was an obvious symbol of something that needed to change, and so we got rid of that very early on.
And you mentioned that you also had listening sessions throughout the country. I understand that you had separate listening sessions with managers and with rank-and-file employees. How did you approach it?
We would start with a very simple introductory statement, at least the ones I did, start with a very simple introductory statement about some of the things that we were focusing on, some of the ideas we have heard and some of the complaints we had heard, and we just open up for questions. And I've done listening sessions with both employees and supervisors separately. I've done them together. At the end of every listening session I've ever done, I give out my email address. And I say, you know what, if you weren't comfortable saying something here, send me an email. And I can't respond to every email, but I read every single email that comes in. So in both little ways and large ways, we sent the message that we really care what you're thinking about. That being said, you know, listening sessions work great in year one, but if you don't deliver on anything that you've heard, then people aren't going to come back in year two. People aren't going to want to offer more ideas. So it was very important at the end of these listening sessions that we cataloged what we had heard and really set about trying to tackle some of these problems.
What were the different things you heard from the rank and file and from managers?
I don't know that we heard significantly different things. There was a couple things. One is that we need more training. In part because of budgetary restrictions over the last couple years, training for instance, our starting investigators wasn't what it should have been. For folks that had been promoted into the supervisory ranks, we hadn't taught them how to be leaders. And so we embarked on a pretty aggressive training effort. Some of the efforts have been coordinated with the Partnership for Public Service that we're now requiring all new supervisors to go through training sessions. We heard about IT challenges within the building. We heard about workplace flexibilities. And that's an important subject because, again, in terms of being a model employer, we didn't have enough different ways for people to work. And so we set out very early on working with our unions, talking to our employees, and talking to our supervisors about, you know, we needed to adapt. We needed to provide the flexibility for people who had, whether it was childcare demands or who wanted to work 4 days a week or who wanted to have alternate schedules. To create those options for them. We rolled it out earlier this year. We've doing a lot of evaluation about how well it's gone, but the initial results are good. It seems to have accomplished what it has, what we intended in terms of increased flexibility. And there was, you know, candidly, probably a little bit of reluctance on the part of managers because it required them, again, not to assume that your employees are always in the office at certain times, and they had to be more nimble as managers. And we've heard very positive feedback from our managers as well.
The quick wins that you've described seem like ones that are any employee would appreciate, right? It gives them a little bit more responsibility. It shows that you trust them. But for managers who are under pressure to produce, I can understand why it might make them nervous. So how did you get them to buy into these changes?
Well, first of all, we showed them that in terms of workplace flexibilities, the Department of Labor was behind other federal departments. So this is a model that had worked elsewhere in the federal government. So we were not embarking on something particularly novel, at least in terms of the federal workforce. Secondly, we made sure that managers knew that these flexibilities applied to them as well. Managers have the same kind of childcare needs. They have the same kinds of personal demands, and ensuring that they could take advantage of these as well. And then finally, being very upfront and saying to our employees and to our unions that, you know, this is something that we are evaluating along the way. And we wanted to see what effects it would have in terms of productivity, what it had in terms of morale. And we were doing it as a trial process. We would do a very rigorous evaluation. And at the end, we'd make a determination about whether this should be made permanent or not. And we're in the middle of that period right now.
I understand it's going to end at the end of next month.
That's right.
In your listening sessions, you also heard different things from people with different backgrounds. You heard different things from people who are white versus people who are of color, particularly black people. Tell me a little bit about the differences that you uncovered.
I think one of the most startling things that came out to us, not only in the listening sessions, but in the employee viewpoint survey results, was the divergence in views towards the department, towards their supervisors, based on race, based on gender. It is fair to say that our African American employees had a had a different view of the workplace than our Caucasian employees, and that disturbed us. And so we started digging a little deeper. We did listening sessions with our the Blacks in Government affinity group here to try to understand why that might be happening. And it's one of the reasons that we are focusing as much as we are now on diversity and inclusion. It's an important topic to me. In addition to my role here at the department, I also co-chair the administration-wide diversity and inclusion committee. And so that's not an easy problem to fix. It's about recruiting a diverse workforce. It's ensuring that we retain them and that we promote them. But beyond simply who you bring in, where they rise within the department, it's creating, again, this broader culture of inclusion that celebrates our differences, that allows people to have divergent views, and respects all people. And we have a ways to go.
What were some of the things that people were telling you about why they might not be as happy as their white counterparts?
It's very dependent on employee to employee, but there was a perception, and I think there's a fair amount of truth to it, that there weren't enough promotion potentials, mobility opportunities within the department. And on that front, I'd say there's probably, that's not necessarily a African-American versus Caucasian distinction. I mean, the Department of Labor, like many other federal departments, has, you know, diversity, has a fair amount of diversity among the lower level positions. That diversity tends not to be there among high level positions. And it's creating career ladders that allow people through their hard work, through their experience, to rise up into other positions. And because we have more African-Americans among the lower grades, that tended to be a view that we heard more often.
We're speaking with Chris Liu, the Deputy Secretary of Labor. One of the other things that I understand you're doing is a civility project. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
You know, about a year and a half ago, right when I started, there was a piece in the New York Times by a Georgetown professor named Christine Porath, and it was titled, a piece in the New York Times titled, Why You Hate Work. And Chris Porath has done really some groundbreaking work about the downsides of incivility in terms of not only productivity, but in terms of, you know, physical health, mental health. And, you know, so this is part of the overall employee engagement. You know, obviously we need more training. We all need more resources here. But part of this is how we treat each other on a day-to-day basis, not only, you know, supervisor to employee, but colleague to colleague. And, you know, we talk a lot about this, but later on this year we're going to be rolling out a broader civility effort, which we are working through with our unions on this.
Can you describe for me how you think it will play out? I mean, first of all, the word civility is a concept. So what does it mean to you?
What it means to me is this. We work on a lot of very hard issues. This is not all about we have to agree with each other all the time. It's learning to disagree without being disagreeable. It's learning to respect differences. It's learning to create an inclusive culture. You know, and as much for me is creating a culture in which people feel free to raise their hand and say, hey, I have a good idea, and it doesn't matter, you know, how junior or senior you are, that we take those ideas seriously. Or the flip of it is somebody raising their hand and saying, hey, I see something wrong here. We ought to fix this. I want to hear from everybody. You know, I start, and the secretary starts these conversations always by, neither of us has a monopoly on good ideas. In fact, the secretary and I often shamelessly borrow ideas from our employees, and we want to create a culture in which we have that free flow of ideas, and you can only do that when you treat each other civilly, when you create as inclusive a culture as possible.
I understand it's in the works, but give me some example of what you think people will be doing under this project.
Well, there's a lot of research about something as simple as how do you conduct a meeting? How do you start the meeting in a way that encourages people to participate? How do you deal with divergent views in a meeting? How do you bring people to consensus? You know, I don't think we have figured out what shape it takes, but it's as simple as, you know, how we greet each other in the hallway, to how we conduct meetings, to how we work through disagreements.
How do you greet people in the hallway?
Oh, I say hello to everyone in the hallway, actually, it's one of my I will be honest. Well, it's one of my favorite things, and I going up to the cafeteria, just talking to our employees, hearing what's on their mind, what's going on in their days.
You've got some wins under your belt now, so you're sort of in the adolescence of this project. What do you need to do to make sure that labor not only stays in the middle of the pack when it comes to large agencies, but actually rises to the top of the list of the best places to work?
We need to institutionalize these changes that we've made. It would be a disappointment to me and the secretary if we came back 5 years from now after we had left, and the policies that we have put in place hadn't stuck. So it's ensuring that the senior career leadership understands the importance of this and that they carry this on long after we're gone. And I do think it has taken shape. I mean, I think when you look at our workforce, there's starting to be a greater buy-in that a more engaged workforce is a more productive workforce. And so it's not me saying it, it's not the secretary saying it, but it's front-line managers understanding that.